Welcome to The Sync Report, the intersection between filmmakers, content creators, and musicians, where we host a weekly conversation with some of the biggest names in film, television, music, and entertainment. Meet industry experts and top-level musicians as we pull the curtain back on music placement and scores, building vital relationships and providing real opportunities for our listeners. Listen to indie filmmakers and content creators present their latest productions and describe specific scenes as they consider music submitted by our audience. Hosted by film star and musician Colin O'Donoghue and his co-host, the godmother of independent films, Rose Ganguza, and The Sync Report's creator and music supervisor, Jason P. Rockwell. Don't forget, tell your friends about us and remember to rate, comment and subscribe to The Sync Report on Apple and across all platforms. Music is the difference between a good film and a great one.
Welcome to The Sync Report.
Thank you, Milfredo and Willow, for that lovely introduction, and welcome to The Sync Report. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome our producer extraordinaire, Paula.
Thanks, Colin. How are you? Have you recovered from the premiere of your movie yet? Luck?
Just about, yeah, I have.
Did you dance with the gypsies in the square?
No, I didn't.
Have you managed to go back to your normal voice after playing the leprechaun in Luck?
Leprechaun Jerry, I have. Although I really wanted him to have my Drogheda accent. Jerry sounds more like this, you know, he's kind of a little bit higher pitched, but no, I sound a little bit more deeper, I guess.
Deeper.
A little bit deeper.
Jerry, why is his name Jerry? I've never heard of Jerry the leprechaun.
Because that's what he was born. He was born Jerry. What do you want me to say, Jason?
Where's the backstory?
Why are you crying in here with the...
Did you create a whole backstory where you were born and what were your parents like?
Jason, just back off.
Sorry. I need attention too.
Leprechaun parents.
Yeah, we know. Listen, Paula, who have we got in the show this week?
Oh, Colin, right. This week we have Trisha Halloran on the show. Trisha Halloran is an expert music curator working as a film and TV music supervisor with well-established directors and producers Jason Reitman, Helen Estabrook, Chris Carter, Liz Feldman, Peter Horton, and more. For 15 years, she's the host of Brave New World on KCRW, an epicenter of the indie rock scene as it emerged from a strictly underground college niche into a powerhouse media genre. Trisha went on to become the content editor for the Ultimate Band List, which later became artistdirect.com, which I might add was an absolute Bible to me when I worked at EMI. Trisha got her first experience as music supervisor in the position of director of A&R at Hum, a production house for brands such as Honda, Toyota, Anheuser-Busch, Citibank, Lexus and Apple. But wanting to include projects for TV and film ultimately led to Trisha running her own company and supervising on shows such as New Amsterdam, Dead to Me, The X-Files, Casual, Castle, The Good Wife, The Big C, Deception Mercy, Life, and Men in Trees, among others. Her film credits include Sugar Mountain, Don Quixote, Trans Fatty Lives, Tully, Crystal, The Space Between, and Roast? And most recently, Sound of Freedom. She's currently working with KCRW on a new podcast about the 80s independent music scene called Bent by Nature, Deirdre O'Donoghue and the Lost Snap Archives, as well as DJing at the weekends on Twitch, mixing up the best new music with vintage favourites from all eras every Sunday from 11 till 12:30 Pacific time. You can find her blog and link to her show and other social media on her website, bravenewworld.net. Let's give a warm welcome to Trisha Halloran.
Hey! Welcome, Trisha. It's so nice to have you on The Sync Report. Obviously, after hearing Paula's introduction, I am curious. At what point did music really become a passion for you? And what was it about the songs that you were curating?
Well, it's funny because I know you had Mimi Chen on. That was one of the episodes that I listened to. And it was listening to KSCA that really made me go, wow, what is this music? And it was a friend of mine, somebody I dated after college, turned me onto it, and they were playing the Bodines and Roxy Music and Suzanne Vega. And in college, I had just been listening to K-Rock, so Oingo Boingo, and you know, that was all great. But this KSCA was like a whole different world of music, and it felt so authentic and so emotional and storytelling. And I just really connected with everything they were playing there. And I think that's what really made me start going down the music rabbit hole, as they say. Mm-hmm.
So Trish, this is Rose. What were you doing for work prior to your start at KCRW? Were you in a related field of study when you attended UCLA?
No, you know, I was a computer science major at UCLA. I was pretty clear that I was going to be a computer programmer. I was sure that was a great field to be in, very lucrative, secure, you know, pensions, yeah, that whole thing. Really, and I worked as a computer programmer for Xerox, or I should say more like the technical half of a sales team, which is very related. And it was fun. Like, it was fun when I started, like a group of us all started together and we would go out and do stuff all the time. And it was fun. But that kind of looked around at the middle management level. I was like, I don't know if that looks like so much fun to me. It just started to look like more, you know, of a grind. So I think I was sort of already thinking like, what else is really out there, you know, besides this computer science.
Were you in California? Did you, is that where you were from and you just sort of fell into?
Yeah. Computer
stuff.
Born and raised in California, and more Northern California where I grew up, and I moved to Los Angeles to go to UCLA. Never left.
Right.
Still here.
And you're still there.
Yeah. I think, you know, my dad brought home a personal computer from work, and I was like, this thing is really cool. Like, can you make a living, like, you know, working on these? And he's like, oh yeah, thumbs up. You know, you're good. I just thought I know a lot of people that work in music have very creative, what is that? The right brain, the left brain? I can never remember. But I have both. Like, I have a very logical side as well. So I really liked the way a computer program, like, you could tell it exactly what to do and it would always do that every single time, you know, once you got it working. There was like always an endpoint that worked. So that really appealed to the logical half of me, but it wasn't really fulfilling the artistic part.
So, but Xerox, especially in the day, was really a very cutting edge company. So what prompted you from Xerox to start taking a more serious look, a more non-structured industry like the music business?
Yeah, and the funny thing is, I don't think I thought it was serious at the time at all. It all seemed like a lark. But what sort of led to it is I had a bad breakup and I was sitting around in my office at Xerox just moping all the time, like couldn't get out of it. I remember playing Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares to You, like over and over. I mean, it was tragic.
That's good music for moping. Yeah.
And my friend that worked with me was just, she was being driven nuts and she was having none of it. So she said, Trisha, you should go down to that station. I think I had started listening to KCRW by then. Some other friends had turned me onto it. And she said, you know, they use phone volunteers at night. Like, why don't you go down there and just get out of this moping thing and go start something new and go volunteer down there and answer phones? And so that's what I did. And once I got into that little public radio station, which was just a hotbed of everything creatively, artistic, musically that was happening in Los Angeles, then I was just hooked. Then it was like, how can I make my living in this field? You know, it just opened up the whole music business to me by being involved in KCRW.
Right. But still, you were able to use your skills from your job.
So I kept my Xerox job, which was a nice, lucrative, comfortable job. But weeknights, I started volunteering at KCRW. And then through my connections at KCRW, I started looking for jobs in the music business. I did find a job at Capitol Records, or more accurately, their distributor, which was called SEMA at the time, that used my computer skills, but also was in the music business. So that was kind of my segue into it. And then after I worked there for a while, a full-time job opened up at KCRW running the music library, which is where you sit and you open all the mail that comes from all the record labels all day and you catalog it for the DJs and you just keep the whole thing organized and you take calls from the record labels and tell them whether you're playing their records or not. And that was like really honestly probably my favorite job of all time.
Yeah.
Because you're just and surrounded by music all day.
And what year was this, Trish, more or less?
I'm so bad with dates, but I'm guessing it was, 90s. Yeah.
But it was still, but this industry was still a very predominantly male-dominated industry. So how did you fit in as a woman? Did you encounter any challenges in that regard?
Yeah, I don't think I really knew them at the time. I was just so excited to be in the business.
Yeah.
But they definitely, a lot of the positions at the station were held by men. Much later on, what kind of prompted me to start leaving KCRW was that I interviewed for the morning position and, they kind of passed me over. So I was sort of like, you know what, they're never going to put a female here. And honestly, they just put their first female on, and this was, 20 years ago. So I guess I was right about that.
Yeah.
But my mentor there was Deirdre O'Donohue, who was a significant, huge influence in my life. And I think you mentioned the podcast, and she became my very dear friend. And she was sort of alerting me to just how to be a female in the business. She was very keen on educating me, stand up for yourself, how to negotiate for a raise. She just alerted me to the fact that it's not the same for men and women and how to just be on the alert for that, which in retrospect, I really appreciate. I think I would have just been like a lamb to the slaughter otherwise.
Right. Wow. Well, we're going to play a clip of Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor, just to show the kind of music you were listening to when you were moping.
I was moping. It's good moping music it is.
I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing, I said nothing can take away these blues, 'cause nothing compares, nothing compares to you.
Oh, we miss you, Prince. What a beautiful song. And Trish, as an LA boy myself, you've just completely made me homesick and remembering like the best parts. K-Rock was like the station when, like you said, Oingo Boingo and Violent Femmes. And oh my God, just the best music came out of there.
And remember Rock Blocks? They would play like four songs in a row from one artist.
Yes.
Nobody does that anymore.
And Rodney on the Rocks. And oh my God, it felt like a party, that station. But as I merged into the music industry, it was KCRW. And that had become such an important hub for the labels to get played on that station. You guys just became like the place where cool music was coming out of. And it's funny because now just hearing that talk with you and Rose, I didn't realize, but I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, the great music minds that do kind of morph into music supervising have come out of KCRW, Jason Bentley and Gary Calamar and my friend Jason Kramer. And I'm like, oh God, I'm thinking it's all males. And that's so...
Yeah. Well, Liza Richardson, she's one of the top, supervisors. Yeah.
Of course.
And Ann Litt has done a little bit too. I think she prefers she's full-time at the station now running the music department, but Ann did a lot of music supervising also.
And I think that just plays into the credit that coming out of that station gave to you guys. How long was it from that transition? And when did you start thinking, I'm going to get out of the DJ booth and move into the editing bay and start music supervising?
Well, I think it started as like, this could be a fun thing to do. And then, as a DJ, it's not like a full-time paid gig. So you're always looking. And I think that's why a lot of KCRW DJs end up also being music supervisors. It's a job you can have and still be on the air. In fact, it helps. And the skill set is very similar. There's definitely things you need to do as a music supervisor that are not in the DJ skill set, but the skill set of like always knowing what the up and coming bands are, knowing who sounds like Led Zeppelin but doesn't cost what Led Zeppelin costs, that kind of skill set is the same as discovering underground bands to put on the air and trying to be the first one to bring them to people's attention. So that's, I think, why that works out. So I think I started, my first movie was called Don Quixote. It never came out, actually, but it was a fan of my Brave New World show on KCRW that was doing this movie. His dad was in the movie business, and he was kind of helping him do this indie film. And we got Bill from Olivia Tremor Control to score it. And it was, the whole thing was so much fun. And I had a friend that was a music supervisor, so she mentored me through the aspects of it that I didn't know, the clearances, how to contact people, you know, faxing. At that time, we faxed. There was no email. We faxed clearance requests and waited anxiously for the faxes to come back in. So she kind of taught me all that part of it. And that was my first time. And I guess it just, I think it was more, well, then I did go to the Ultimate Band List, as you guys mentioned, and Artist Direct. But then when I was looking for something to do, when that whole internet thing kind of imploded, then I was like, what, you know, where else can I be employed? Because by then I was not working full-time at KCRW anymore in the music library, because I'd kind of hit that glass ceiling, but I still was doing my show, I think weekend nights, that is when it was on then. And actually, it was Ann Litt that interviewed for this position first at the music house called Hum. Yeah. And then she referred me to it because she wasn't interested in it. And then that just worked out. So that really was in the trenches, like music supervising. Every week we were doing searches for clients, even if just to set the tone for a commercial. And then commonly they were trying to license songs. So that was really where I really had to get tightened up on the whole clearance process and, you know, really started learning how to negotiate with labels and publishers and try to, you know, get the best deal for my clients and all that kind of businessy side of it. So that was really the first full-time music supervising position that I had. And that kind of segued into TV. It was actually another person from KCRW that got my first TV gig, which was Men in Trees, a show with Anne Heche. And I was like, oh, wait, this is super fun. This is in a way, way much more fun than commercials. So I wanted to do more of that. And the music house, they were just wanted to stay focused on commercials. So I eventually, after I had a couple more shows, I just split off and it just kind of all came from there and kept going, knock on wood.
So Tricia, one show I believe is going into its fifth season is New Amsterdam. Can you share with us a really rewarding moment from working on that show?
You know, I always have my favorites that I'm trying to get into TV shows, but you have to have the right, it's all about what serves the scene. And sometimes just even songs you love or artists you love, just the right opportunity doesn't come along. But the season finale and season through was really the build up towards these two characters coming together that had been building up for three seasons to this moment. And this was a case where this happens occasionally, where the two showrunners who were the main decision makers wanted kind of different things. Like the one showrunner is super into these very, like the vocals for him, you have to feel it. You have to feel every emotion in those vocals. They have to be achy, but also authentic, not fake at all. And then the other showrunner really was keen on the build. Like he really wanted the epic, you know, finish when they finally kiss at the end. I went through so many songs and there was always one of them that was not satisfied. So finally, we really got to this artist, Luke Sital Singh. That's a hyphenated last name, Sital Singh. He's so brilliant. He's British, his voice, but he lives in Los Angeles now. And his voice just is so emotional and heartfelt. And it was perfect for this scene. And it went through all the approvals. And then at the last minute, the producer that wanted the build like was having a wobble. And he's like, I don't know. I don't think it's there. You know, it's not building enough. And I was thinking, good God, I've pitched them hundreds of songs. Like I can't, there is nothing else.
Been there.
So I said, what if we could add on, you know, what if we could modify the song to like add the build at the end? Because the song was so perfect. And it did have a build. It had a huge build, but it just wasn't enough for this guy. So that's what we ended up doing. I was going to have Luke do it because he has a studio, you know, here in LA. He lives here, but we ended up having our composer do it, who's also an amazing composer, Craig Wedren. He was in a band called Shudder to Think.
Oh, and, my God. Yeah.
You remember Shudder to Think?
Yes, I do. I did. Actually, I worked with Craig before with the David Lynch Foundation. Craig, he's so lovely human.
Yeah, he's amazing. So Craig is our composer. So I knew I got Luke's permission, obviously, but I was like, I knew that he's an artist, a songwriter, musician, and a composer Craig is. So I knew that he could respect the song and still make what the producers wanted. And it came out great. So that song was Honest Man. A beautiful song.
Funny you mention it, because I think we actually have a clip of Honest Man by Luke Sita Singh.
Wow. That song, that really pulls at the heartstrings.
Yeah.
It really does.
I mean, if you guys ever get a chance to see him perform, he's incredible. And he has a really funny sense of humor, too. Like, his songs are very serious and mostly sad. But when he's on stage, he's telling funny stories, and he's an amazing guy.
Right. I think Paula, didn't you see him in London?
I did. I saw him at the Union Chapel a few years ago.
Oh, they incredible. Made a live recording of that, the Union Chapel.
Oh, they did. Yes, yeah. I remember now.
Yeah, there's a
yeah,
record
yeah.
of that.
That's brilliant.
Well, we have to check so that fantastic. Out for sure.
That was the show you went topless, right? I got to get that show.
Well, this is Kevin here. You know, I have a question. It must have been really satisfying to finally see that scene come to life with that song. But can you mention a sync that might have been tricky due to how the scene was shot?
Always. They're so tricky sometimes. But I think with on-camera music, it's always really interesting because it's a process and it just always seems to go the way it's going to go, regardless of how much you plan. You plan it. The Space Between is a film I worked on recently that had a few live scenes in it that were kind of tricky. But one thing that comes to mind recently is we in New Amsterdam, there was an episode that called for the characters to watch a clip, like a YouTube clip of a guy playing Clair de Lune. They scripted Clair de Lune, but it's one of my favorite songs. Did they script it? Did I pick it? I can't even remember now. It all merges together. But they played Clair de Lune, and then you're watching this guy playing the piano. So for some reason, they didn't shoot that because the character watching it was himself playing it, but he was much older. So they didn't shoot it. They just pulled some stock clips, and they, at least they sent them to me for my approval. They sent me like 9 clips, and they said, which of these looks like, they're playing Clair de Lune? And I was like, none of them, because Clair de Lune, you're playing. I mean, I'm not even a musician, but even I can tell, like, you're playing wide, like you're playing low notes and high notes when you play that song. And all these clips were people like playing chopsticks or something, they were like right in the middle of the keyboard. So I was like, well, none of those match. You can't use any of them. But at least I got them to pick. There was one that was kind of like a wide shot and it came around and they didn't really focus on the hands. I'm like, you please use this one at least so it's not completely embarrassing that, there's no way that character is playing what you're hearing. It's always tricky because I just find the directors and even the editors, they're a little like, oh, it's fine. Nobody's going to notice. I'm like, every musician watching is going to notice.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when you get down to the details, they really do matter. We have a clip of Clair de Lune. Why don't we go ahead and play that, Mofredo?
So Trisha, I nearly zoned out there listening to
sleep.
But I wanted to add a couple of questions about your music choices in the Netflix show Dead to Me, which I absolutely loved. You ended up pairing heavy metal music with Christina Applegate's character. Now generally, how do you decide what music to use with certain characters on a show? And what were you trying to communicate about this character by using that specific genre of music, which is not used very often.
No, it's not used very often. That is a great question. It's actually my favorite part, is picking specific music to specific characters. That particular choice was actually made by the showrunner, Liz Feldman, who she used to work on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and she's really funny. Like, she has a really good sense of what is funny and what is not funny. So the whole show, Dead to Me, is sort of about how you can appear one thing on the outside. So Orange County, very, you know, everything's shiny and happy and people have plenty of room and nice houses. But what this character is feeling on the inside is more like what heavy metal sounds like. So she has, she's living this glossy life, but in the inside she's dying. So it was the showrunner's choice to go heavy metal. And I mean, she wanted to really go there, like the heavier, the better. So once, once we established that, then I always had to have that music handy for Christina's scenes when she would go there. And, you know, it was really just the darker, the better. Like if it had the F word, fantastic. If the vocals were really guttural, that was even better. Like she just really, there was no middle ground for Liz. It had to be like all the way.
Trisha, with your, I mean, obviously you have a massive, massive awareness of music and probably all genres, but metal, is that something that you have a very solid grasp of as well?
No, no, I'm not saying that's my forte.
Right.
But I think as a music supervisor, you, I think all music supervisors I know can go deep into any genre. Like it's especially easy in this time of the internet to just spend, you know, a day doing research and then, you know, learn about it. Also for this these particular choices, it wasn't like I needed period authentic or, you know, it was more just like, I just needed music that really sounded harsh. We also, I know all music supervisors lean on their industry people. You know, I went out to record labels that I knew had that kind of music and I said, what do you have that could suit this? And, you know, you explain what you want and get some choices back. But I was going to also, I thought it was a great question. Like how do I decide what music to use with characters in general? Like I said, that was kind of stipulated by the first script, but it is really fun. That show Casual that I worked on is a great example because there was three main characters and they all had very different taste in music. And it kind of evolved, I think, from their, it's partly their age, and in a script, there's usually some description of the character. So Alex was like a slacker guy, really into his music, kind of a hipster, like it's central to his life. And he knew all eras of music. So Fleetwood Mac, Al Green, and even up to new KCRW type stuff. So that was all, you know, what we used for him. And then his sister Valerie was a little poppier. She was more Amy Winehouse and, you know, more contemporary things that she would like that she could sing along to. And then there was Valerie's daughter Laura, who was a millennial, so her stuff was very edgy. She was young at the time and going through a lot of stuff, so hers was the more emotional, like edgy songs. So it's fun when you're when you start working on a show to make like a playlist for each character, and just even if you don't end up using those songs, it just helps everybody, I think, kind of get the mood for those characters. And it's a fun way to kind of flesh them out.
Well, I think we have a clip of Rage Unrestrained by Excessum, which I think I've pronounced that properly. But yeah, let's spin it, Alfredo.
I fucking hate everyone. And I fucking hate everything. I want to eliminate this fucking hypocrisy.
Oh, I was having that kind of a day yesterday.
That was interesting.
I have kind of a good story about the metal on that show. Actually, the first song that you heard when she first played metal in the car was a German heavy metal band that I think the showrunner picked before I came on, because they had already started working on the episode when I started. And we almost couldn't clear that because it was a German band and they were with a major. We went through BMG or something, and BMG kept, I might be wrong about BMG, so don't necessarily take that to heart if I'm slagging somebody. They couldn't like reach the band. They were like, they're not responsive. You know, we can't get it. And meanwhile, my showrunner completely attached to this song. And I think she was singing along to it is why when they shot it, before I came on.
So you're obviously stuck.
I would have cleared it first. Yeah. I mean, they had a backup footage, but it wasn't as fun. And we ended up reaching out to the band directly on Facebook, and that is how we found them. And they were like, yeah, we want that song used. Like, meanwhile, so their own publisher couldn't even reach them for some... It was crazy. So, but then part two, their publisher ended up asking for so much money for that song that we never used them again. So then I replaced it with bands like Excess, you know, and the like subsequent episodes and seasons, we just used, you know, stuff we could license a lot more reasonably. So they, you know, they could have had a, they kind of priced themselves out of the market.
So Trish, you worked with one of my favorite directors, Jason Reitman, very creative director on a film called Tully, which starred Charlize Theron. And there was a particularly challenging thing of getting the Cyndi Lauper album into the film. Give us a little background on that.
Yeah, you know, Jason is amazing. I mean, I love working with him. He has a very clear idea what he wants, and he's really good with music himself as well. So the film was actually pretty much finished, and we had already spent our entire music budget. There was a lot of things he wanted. There was a lot of songs that he really had to have that we used, and some big songs. And we were done, and then he was editing this scene where the two characters drive into, I think they're in New Jersey, and they drive to Brooklyn. And we were all on the stage, you know, kind of doing some initial mixes. And he turned to me. No, I guess it must have been editing. We weren't mixing yet. And he said, Trisha, I want to play an entire album here. I was like, okay. I want to play the Cyndi Lauper album.
Oh, wow.
I was like, okay. I go, could we use like Sheryl Crow or Alanis Morissette or somebody that doesn't have co-writers on every single one of her songs? Because that's going to be, you know, it's just like a whole different premise. Like if I can go to Sheryl Crow's label and publisher and be like, you're getting this pot of money, which by the way, I didn't have the money yet. I had to get that separately. That's one thing. But if I have to go to Cyndi's label, Cyndi's publisher and 8 other publishers because she does co-writes, that's a whole different, you know, equation. But no, he had to have that particular Cyndi Lauper album. What's it called? It's the one from 1983 with Time After Time on it. So we played like 8 seconds of every song to show the progression of time as these characters drive into town. And it was just, strategy. Like we got Cyndi Lauper on board first through the label, because at least all the recordings were on the same record label, obviously one album. And Jason actually met with Cyndi and screened the movie for her. To get her kind of, you know, to show her what a great film it was and get her into it. And then once the label was on board, then I went to Cyndi Lauper's publisher because she did have a piece of most of the songs. And I got everybody on this MFN plan. Like I just took, we got an overage and I just took that chunk and I'm like, this is what we have. You know, we're only playing a few seconds of each song. And once I had them on board, then I went out to all the co-writers and I was like, look, Cyndi's already on board with this deal. So, you know, cross her at your own peril. And here's the deal we're offering. And everybody took it.
Yeah. But you know, the thing that nobody ever talks about is besides the initial licensing fee for any piece of music, it's the uptick that an artist will get from having a song either appear in a film or a television piece in terms of downloads or any other possible potential financial remuneration for that. The artists are aware of that. Actually, the publishers, of course.
Yeah. The publishers and labels really hate that argument when you put it to them.
Yeah.
I think they just feel like once we go down that path, and they're protecting their copyrights, which right. I get. Like that's their business. But I know the individual artists do definitely see that. In fact, we recently put this longtime favorite band of mine called Her Space Holiday into New Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And he called me a few weeks later after it aired and he was like, I haven't even got paid for this sync yet. He said, but my Spotify plays have jumped so much that like I'm buying my daughter new shoes. And, you know, it was like this whole list of things he'd been able to purchase. And he's a struggling musician.
Yeah.
And so it was, well, I don't know if he's struggling, but, you know, he's not rolling in it.
In this work that you do, Trish, how often do you get asked to create a theme song for any of these shows?
You know, I don't think that, yeah, I don't think that's been very common lately. It has happened to me in the past. We did license a song for, anyway, we licensed a song from a local band, but the studio was like so horrified that we licensed an original song that they made the band do a buyout, and they basically bought that song for life from the band. So they wouldn't have to keep paying, you know, because theme songs pay differently and you pay for a long time. Those are really expensive to get original songs, especially recognizable ones. So creating is the way to go. We've had a couple shows where, like TV shows, I think they do this less and less though, because of the way that streaming services air songs and air TV shows. They don't really play, you know, they get right out, they get right in, like people skip the intro. So I feel like that type of theme music is becoming less and less important, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, there are two schools on that. I mean, you know, people saying now that, you know, maybe people are going back into that whole thing. And I mean, it's not like it used to be, for sure.
Yeah.
But you know, you can think of a lot of bands like, you know, the one that did the theme for Friends, or the one that did the theme for The Sopranos, which were kind of like unknown bands who did something and then made a lot of money off of the fact that these things last forever.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best for a band, to get that thing where people are hearing 30 seconds of it every single time they watch an episode. Then that's golden.
Another impressive placement that you did was the James Bond, You Only Live Twice. Explain a little bit about how hard that was.
Yeah, that was also Tully. I have so many Tully stories, but I loved working on that film. Again, Jason had to have that song, and he had created a cover of it that this actress that he knew, who was also a musician, did on her cell phone. She had a band with her sister called Beulah Bell, and it was a beautiful, very simple, very evocative version. But I'm thinking, the Bond franchise, like, they're going to let us license a song, you know, that's like their bread and butter.
Right.
We didn't have a ton of money, but again, I'm very much of the mind, like, never say never. So I put the request in, it was denied. And then I went back and I said, look, could we just, and there's a little bit of a twist in the film, and I was under strict orders, like, not to give that away. So I couldn't really explain why this particular film was so important. And I thought the Bond people are filmmakers. So first thing, this is always good advice for a music supervisor. Like, you're working with really talented writers, have them write a letter. So I had Jason write a letter to Barbara Broccoli, saying, you know, explaining why he wanted to use the song. And he also professed, like, his deep respect for the Bond franchise and how he grew up watching those films. It was an awesome letter. So these writers, they can really throw it on when they need to. So that letter got a meeting, and then they did a phone meeting, Jason and Barbara, and he explained the whole thing and why he wanted to use it, and it was approved.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. So we're going to play the cover by Beulah Bell of You Only Live Twice.
Beautiful. Trisha, in the film The Space Between with Kelsey Grammer, you know, you had to wear several hats putting the music in the scenes because the character is a musician. Can you explain your process in deciding on the music for this character and how you ended up creating the soundtrack, essentially?
Yeah, that was such a great film, and I feel like it didn't really get a lot of attention, so I urge everyone to watch it if you love music. It's set in current day, but it's set in 1996, so it's kind of addressing that period that we were talking about earlier, where the music business was really like on fire and there was all these great bands being discovered, but it's kind of the tail end of that where labels were starting to realize like, oh, this is a gold mine, and they were starting to get really greedy. And I think that's sort of the point of the script, partly was that was the period where things sort of transitioned into the music business being more business and less about artistry and creativity. So Kelsey plays this character, Mickey Adams, who is a kind of a washed up musician. Like at one point he was very much the Van Morrison of his generation, but now everybody's forgotten about him. And there's a younger character that works in the mailroom at like a Geffen Records type of record label, who's determined to like rise to the top and like own the record label and be the big guy with the yacht and the girls and the everything. And he has this assignment of trying to drop the Kelsey Grammer character from this label. And the Kelsey Grammer character, Mickey Adams, he's crazy. Like he's completely just, you know, gone batshit in an eccentric, lovable musician kind of way. So they end up starting to interact, and through discovering Mickey Adams' catalog of music, this younger character rediscovers what is really important about music and how it can move your soul and why it's not the most important thing to own like a massive record label, but it's just to bring good music to the fore. So obviously a story near and dear to my heart. But so the assignment was, okay, so create an album, because we hear multiple songs throughout the film. Create an album that sounds like Van Morrison could have written it, and it was recorded in the 70s, but we didn't want to use pre-existing songs because we wanted this audience to also discover the music. So it was a tall order, but I collaborated a lot with the director, and it came out. I have to say, I love how it came out. We ended up reaching out to 90s musicians to write the songs instead of going with what, you know, maybe more like a Jackson Brown type songwriter. And mm-hmm. we worked with Rivers Cuomo from Weezer, who was fantastic, brilliant songwriter, really took direction well, like had no ego involved. Like he's very zen about the whole thing. There's no like, well, I wrote it that way. And, you know, he's the opposite of that. He's like, how can we make it better, Trisha? You know, tell me the, you know, he was fantastic. So the director and I made a playlist of songs that we loved from the 70s to kind of inspire him. And then we just gave him specs on particular songs, because every song kind of unfolds something else in the script. So they sort of help drive the action, so to speak. So they had to contain, one of them had to contain certain lines, and they all had to address certain things in their lyrics. And he wrote the demos. And then we found this amazing studio called New Monkey, which you guys are probably familiar with, because they have the vintage gear to make it sound like it really was, you know, could have been recorded in the 70s. And I have to say, one of your producers, Robert, was such a champ through this whole process. He brought in such great talent for us and, you know, recorded the songs, re-recorded, remixed, you know, different vocalists. Like he really went to the mat, and it came out great. We used this local band that's a favorite of mine called Mini Bar, and they were kind of the house band to play all the music part of it. And it was funny because Rivers wasn't involved in the recordings at all. He just wrote the demos, which we ended up releasing as part of the soundtracks, because it was so fun to hear the contrast. And then the production was just up to us. It's like, okay, well, let's get this band in, let's go to New Monkey because they have these cool vintage gear, and let's just produce the songs the way we want them to sound. Nick Luca was our producer. He was amazing, and it was a really, really fun process to just create an album really from start to finish, but have it, you know, have a purpose of telling this character's narrative. Evolution through the film.
So cool.
It's a dream project.
Yeah, what a fun gig that would have been.
Well, we have a clip of I See Colors with Kelsey Grammer singing. If you want to take a listen, spin it, Alfredo.
Be a place. Don't turn the light on. I'm living the life. Riding in silence. Tears in my eyes. I see colors.
That's really beautiful. Trish, you have one of your recent projects called Sound of Freedom. Describe a little bit about what the film's about and what the experience was for you working on something with such heavy subject matter, which is based on a true story. And what's the song from this project that stands out most for you?
Yeah, that was also an incredible project. The director, Alejandro Monteverde, is an incredible director. And they deliberately, because it is a dark subject matter, it's the true story of Tim Ballard. He was a U.S. government agent, and he quit his job in order to go into other countries and rescue children from sex traffickers, because he could see what was happening, but his agency didn't have the ability to go to other countries. It could arrest the traffickers when they came in. And so this has now gone on to become like a worldwide foundation where they just send in like SEAL trained teams to rescue kids. And there's usually a big sting operation involved. And so this film, it hasn't come out yet. I don't have a release date, but you can, if you Google it, you'll find the website and you can see the trailer. Sound of Freedom stars Jim Cavaziel. The director, really, they made a choice to make the film very beautiful because the subject matter is so dark and there's nothing explicit or anything like that in the film. It's just more, you can see what, you know, you see what's happening and these kids are kidnapped. It's a horrible, horrible story, but with a happy ending, and they shot it so beautifully. And then we really used music from some English, some Spanish. It takes place mostly in South America, the film, but they go back and forth between the United States and South America.
So, and where did they shoot it, Trish?
Is a good question that I do not know the answer to, actually.
We've stumped the guest.
And then also, this has become a very serious topic because of all of the border crossings and the sex trafficking that's going on coming from Central and South America over the Mexican border.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the film, they're just talking about one specific instance.
Yeah.
But it's a worldwide problem, and in the
huge problem.
And in the credits in the film, it talks about what a worldwide issue it is, and how many kids are affected worldwide, and how now this guy has devoted his life really to correcting this problem, and it's incredibly impressive.
Sounds amazing. We look forward to seeing it. Thank you so much, Trish.
You're welcome.
Now we got to play the Sinead song. Do we have something? Milfredo? Anyone?
Si no creyera en lo que agencio, si no creyera en mi camino, si no creyera en mi sonido, si no creyera en mi silencio, ay, qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera.
Oh, I don't like to show favoritism, but I love Latin music. Oh, there's something so incredible about it.
That's Mercedes Sosa. The song is La Maza, and it was written by Silvio Rodriguez, who's a Cuban musician and leader of the, like, one of the just more of the rebellious side down there, Nueva Trova movement. He's really one of the greatest songwriters of all time. So a lot of people have covered that song, but her version of it is completely amazing. And it's really about striving for freedom. So it was really perfect for the film.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh man, Trish, I'd love to spend a week in your shoes. Oh, what an incredible life.
But, you know, we only covered the highlights.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like we'd need four shows to cover your entire.
Yeah.
Well, my point more was there's a lot of, you know, there's some Dredge projects in between there.
We all have.
I really want to see The Space Between. And
yeah, I really want people to watch it.
Music, it's
and I should have name checked the director, Rachel Winter. It was her first film. But she's been an indie film producer for a long time. I don't know, Rose, if you know her.
Yeah, I do.
But
I do.
She's done a lot of great
Wonderful.
Films. And this was her first directing
amazing.
Project.
Yeah, I mean, the indie films obviously are more of a challenge than a network television show.
They're different.
On the other hand, they can be very...
Yeah, personally, I find that the indie world, you have a little bit more freedom as a music supervisor, you know, because a lot of the directors aren't as, you know, working with someone like Jason, you know, he knows exactly what he wants. And then the music supervisor, you know, Trisha becomes an attorney at that point. She's just processing paperwork.
Yeah. No, it's really hard. And a lot of times we then revert to doing covers or going in studio and doing, you know, doing our own tracks and stuff. Yeah. But, you know, it becomes fun.
Yeah. And I think on TV too, you have an amazing amount of freedom there because unlike a film, the directors are really the showrunners and they are doing, you know, they're writing one show, shooting one show, editing three shows, mixing another show. Like they don't have time to micromanage the music.
Well, the function of a director.
It's like, give me three choices. Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Function of a director in television and the function of a director in film are just two very different animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you prefer then, Trisha?
Well, I like them both. It's like Rose said, like sometimes in the indie film, you have, it is a more creative process and the projects are gorgeous and beautiful and the filmmakers are, you know, so passionately devoted to whatever story they're telling. And TV can also still happen and does, especially now, but it is much more of like, we're getting these episodes out, you know, we're getting this episode
out
this week and next episode next week. So in a way it's more fulfilling because things air faster. Like that Sound of Freedom, I've been working on it for 3 years. It still hasn't come out, you know? Yeah.
But that is
But
it's also why a lot of indie filmmakers are going into that hybrid space of limited series, which becomes like a very long feature film.
Yeah.
I mean, you see it in Stranger Things, this last season. I don't know if it's their final season, but each one of those episodes is feature length. They're an hour and a half each. And you could see that with increased amounts of money, the Duffer Brothers got a little bit more creative on the music side of it. Can afford more than they had before.
Once they have a success and it can be proved in its initial season, and then you can get a bigger budget and do more of what you want in the later season.
We never have enough money for music in our indie films. Never.
Yeah, no.
Well, it's been so well for Kate Bush and Metallica, hasn't it?
I know, that's a crazy story, right? About Kate Bush.
Mad.
What a great
story. She's very happy.
Well, Metallica have just gone number one now after the last two episodes.
It just shows the power of music placement, though. Yeah. It is the new radio. It's where people are finding their music now.
100%.
Well, we saw that like early on with shows like Glee when Ryan Murphy was pushing the envelope of Spotify and everything like that, you know, way, way back when. And, you know, now it seems so long ago, but it did show the correlation between what you're watching and then what you want to hear down the road.
But Trisha, I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's been a transformation now that a lot of people who would traditionally have stayed in film are migrating a lot to television? Has there been a transformation in terms of the cinematic and music quality that goes along with that?
I think, I think it started really with Netflix and streaming shows, cable shows to a certain degree, but for a while there was a big difference between network shows and what I would call streamers or even HBO Max or which I guess previously was cable, where bigger, you know, projects were more artistically significant there. Now I think the networks have really upped their game. So that's still happening there. But I think there's been a slow evolution, I guess is my point, starting with when the streamers started till now, when they're becoming really, they have the ability now to attract amazing talent that would never have been on a network TV show. So that's been building for a while. And I definitely see that. And all that means is there's more great projects out there for everybody because
The budgets also have gone up.
Yeah. The budgets have gone up. Not that music supervisors are getting paid more.
If you do a show for HBO Max or HBO, you know, the lowest budget you're going to be at is about $16 million an episode, which we hardly ever have
that for an indie film. Sometimes you don't even have $1 million for an indie film.
No, exactly. So, you know, it gets really
Yeah,
it is very attractive, even though, you know, people say, I'm not going to sell out, I'm not going to do TV. But, you know, if now with this creation of this in-between space, or the upside down world, as I call it, you know, it's sort of like really creative, really great indie film directors feel like they're not selling out, that they're giving a big, they're given a bigger canvas. So,
And they're just getting a bigger budget, which means they can do what they want. Budget. After they make their first film, they're all, you know, painfully aware that you cannot make exactly what you want with no money. You just can't.
I just sort of don't like when they just stay in that space, you know, and then don't go back to doing features. You know, I
be
like
nice
when
to
they go
back,
back
and forth. Yeah.
But I also have to say, Tricia, there is, it's been reluctance, but I think the publishers are being more open to these step deals. I just worked on a film, and the only reason why I took the film, because I just felt for the director, you know, it's a first time film. She raised $100,000 to make a feature, you know, it's like, and I'm like, well, you know, look, I know a lot of unsigned talent that just looking for credit. In the end, we got music from Brandon Boyd, Donovan, Susie Quattro, Dave Curson from Pearl Jam, you know, all because we created these step deal opportunities where the artist, publisher, and label rolling the dice with the artist if they will earn on it. And I find, and again, it, you know, it depends on who you're talking to, the publishing company, you know, houses. But if you can get to those, the executives, you know, you could push it through if it's like a special project.
Yeah, I think, I've had some success with that as well. And I think label by, you know, depending on the label or the publisher, they're starting to definitely have more of a blanket approach to that, you know, and why not? It get, you know, it helps them give the music supervisor what they want, which means that supervisor will come back to them for future projects. And like you said, the film wins, they win. So, and I think as long too, what I find the sticking point lately is they just want to make sure they're participating in the entire, it's not about box office. You know, it used to be a step deal was about box office, but now it's like all revenues. And as long as you are using that language where all revenues from the film, streaming, box office, otherwise are going to be counted towards your step deal, then they're in. I think it's a smart move. And you know, you get better deals up front, and then, you know, there might be a bit of a painful pill to swallow, you know, the steps. But and then I did that for one film, and then the once we got, we didn't even make it to the steps, but once we were licensing, so we had the film festival rate, and then we had upon distribution the rate, you know, and that was a, that's where the steps really started. And then the filmmaker wanted to renegotiate that. I'm like, look, you are already, I don't think you quite understand what's happening
it's done.
You're getting a rock bottom entry level deal on this song, you know, and you're going to pay more down the line, but this is like, there's no under this amount for this song. That just doesn't exist.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is we, you know, we got, I got the Pixies, you know, the, it's because, you know, you got to do the, you know, an MFN deal for everybody on, on those
on
type of deals.
Yeah.
So the Pixies were the last one that we got in. And I'm just like, guys, be gentle, please just be gentle, because it's just, you know, your decision affects seven other songs.
Right.
But there's also a case for, you know, getting with a record label and just like blanketing. Like when we did, when Bishop Stevens and I did Once in a Lifetime, if Universal hadn't have come in and said, we'll give you 60s, 70s music, we would have never had a soundtrack, because we were doing it for Miramax, and it was like, we didn't really have a big budget on, on Kill Your Darlings, which was all 1940s music. Decca came in and just, you know, just gave us their, you know, there's, we didn't, again, it was a $3.5 million budget. What were we going to do? You know, so. Yeah.
And then what did the publishers, library. Did the publishers then get on board with whatever Decca gave
you? Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, it was the, you know, it was the quality of the project and the past we had,
that helps.
Everything else, but we didn't really have a great music budget on that.
Yeah.
I'm definitely a fan. Definitely.
Thank you so much, Tricia. It was really an education.
It was great, great connecting with all of you.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Jace.
Hey, Jason. You okay?
Yeah, I'm good. Just buried in paperwork.
Oh, for the sync report.
Not this time. Move me no mountain.
That indie film you're music supervising?
Yeah.
sounds like a great project. What's the problem?
It's a brilliant film and we're building a great soundtrack, but you can't imagine how much paperwork I deal with for these films.
Have you heard of Sync Lodge?
First, you got to draft up the sync request forms.
I've heard of Sync Lodge.
Then drafting and issuing contracts.
Yep, Sync Lodge is great, Paula. It does everything a music supervisor needs.
Then deliver the cue sheet. It never ends.
Doesn't Sync Lodge do all of that automatically?
Sweat Lodge? What are you guys banging on about? I got real issues I'm sharing with you guys.
Yeah, lots of issues.
We're trying to tell you, Jason. Sync Lodge is a new platform for music supervisors. It helps you to source the music, sync songs against scenes, draft up sync requests, and even creates the cue sheets once you've locked in the music to the film.
Whoa, Sync Lodge does all that?
It's true, Jason. I just started using it for the sync report. And it's not only saving time, but it's so easy to use. I'm actually enjoying the work.
You guys are the best. Sync Lodge sounds amazing and exactly what I need for music supervising. Why am I always the last one to hear about these things?
I've been telling you about Sync Lodge for weeks.
Don't feel bad, Edge, for not telling me sooner. I know you're busy. You're a good guy.
Paula, is my mic on? Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Edge.
Guys, what's the name of that program again?
Sync Lodge.
That is something to scream about. Yes, you too can be cool like Edge and use cutting edge technology to help you with your film and TV productions. No matter if you're a music supervisor, director, producer, editor, save time and increase proficiency with Sync Lodge.
I need to find a new gig.
Sync opportunities.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We're taking on new life, new realms, new realities in this crazy world we call the Sync Report. Oh my God, do I see my producer? Do I see Paula Flack on stage? Hello, Paula.
Hi.
How lovely for you to join us.
Thanks. I thought I would join you. I was eating my dinner and you know, stuff.
Well, you know, it's all of a sudden out of the blue on a Sunday, I'm like watching my Westerns, enjoying the afternoon here in Ireland. And my producer's like, hey, you know, the show's going to start an hour early today.
I'm like, oh, okay. Hold on a minute. Is that how it went down?
It's a very clever idea, but I was not ready for it at all. But
yeah, thanks. Thanks. Thanks for that.
Oh, Paula, some exciting stuff is happening in our world, I think. Yeah, no. But why don't we go ahead? Why don't we say quick hellos to the team? And then let's get into some music. Hello, Phil. So are you ready to, you know, step into these new shoes as music director for the support?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm ready. I've got a new suit, new tie, new office. Oh. I've got to have my name put on the door. Not that anyone else can appreciate it, but, you know, it's all official. Yeah, of course.
Well, I was going to say, you posted some pictures recently. Excellent. Well, we are going to have some fun, Phil. I'm really excited about the music you're creating for the Sync Report TV show. But I don't feel bad because, you know, Milfredo now is going to be doing the music supervising for the show, which is absolutely exhilarating. Cool. Milfredo, are you ready for all this new work heading? Not just music supervising, but we talked earlier. Kev had this brilliant idea of a weekly DJ session that we're going to start to set up with you. Mm. And then obviously, you know, as a panelist and as the DJ and as the constant voice of the Sync Report, what's going to happen? You're going to have to either give up your live events or just keep letting
people down as I always do. It's perfect.
You can promise, never let us down.
Promise the world, deliver nothing. That's me.
He has to keep doing the live events and put the Sync Report in front of his DJ booth.
Exactly that, Kevin. Correct answer. The boss has spoken. That's exactly what I need to do. Yes.
Total rebrand.
Rebrand. My old promoter used to say, if it ain't wrong, it ain't right with Milfredo. He said, it's just like that. That was it. And I thought, That is the gospel, right there. It is, yeah.
Which I think you're like broadcasting from a church at the moment, if I'm not mistaken.
I am. Yeah, can you hear it echoing away? I've got me pulpit all set up with me Nexus Pioneers all ready to go. So, yeah, Sync Report from the church.
I got some confessions for you.
Oh. Hello, France. Tune in, France. Thanks. How's it going in France?
Man, it's great. I'm the life of a scooter boy. I'm loving it.
I see you on your scooter. Actually, I'm so jealous. I told Estrella I want to get a scooter. She's like, but it rains in Ireland. I'm like, oh. Wow.
It doesn't rain in the south of France.
Honestly, Vig, so much exciting stuff's happening with you.
Yeah.
We're actually going to bring in a director and producer, actually my friend, producer Chris Ralph, who is an incredible producer, label executive, was the producer on Fairy Tale, the movie where I actually got the opportunity to meet Colin O'Donoghue, the host of The Sync Report. And he is now working on a new documentary, which they're going to funnel. I think we're going to take like two or three tracks for The Room, but everything's going through your writing retreat in November. Is that correct?
That's correct. We can start things and finish them there or get some ideas. And I'm loving it. And they were so excited to not only give us a brief, but show us what they want and allow the artists to dig deep on what they think works as well. No, it was great. And we have a couple of others that have signed on. David Russo, the guy who does all the music for...
Penny Dreadful, Gotham. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's another filmmaker named Susan Johnson, also doing some a new project. And so she's going to send us some information so that at the retreat, we can try to like conjure up what we need. And I'm just excited because Phil Mason's going to be there. So everybody else...
Phil
really
and
count.
Paula and me, and oh my God, we're going to bring as much of the Sync Report. And then again, you know, I on Friday, I heard from my friend and the former featured guest on the Sync Report, Des Shaw, Bob Geldof's partner at Zinc Media. And he has a film he's going to bring to Vinks for this retreat. So if you are a songwriter, if you want to know and learn and try and have an opportunity for real sync opportunities, definitely check out vinks.com. Check out the French Retreat. It is an incredible opportunity for anybody that wants to, A, have fun with us, but more importantly, to learn the craft of sync and scoring and cues. We're going to need all of this stuff. The facility is amazing. You'll live on site. I think, what is there, four or five studios, Vinks?
Yes, every room is tied to each other, and I have a couple of other producers coming to create workstations as well. So it's a grown folks slumber party, really.
We have a couple more people to say hello to, and then we're going to start playing some music. Heather, you made it. Are you in Canada? Are you in Iceland? Are you in the tri-state area? Are you in Fargo? Where the hell are you?
I am in Montreal, as usual. I went somewhere today.
But talk like you're in Fargo.
Well, gee.
Apple picking.
You're really putting me on the spot now. I'm not sure I'm ready to get into character.
I love it. What do you mean you went apple picking? Is that the time of year? It seems like you missed the season.
No, I think like they were like, yeah, you're good for apples, but there's no blueberries as of yesterday. And I was just like, where did all the blueberries? I don't know.
The deer eat them. Trust me, the deer love blueberries. Oh my God. You've never seen a deer smile until you give it a blueberry for the first time.
I never have seen
a deer
smile.
Heather, you know I love you. I'm so glad you're part of this crazy scene. Lisa, I want to say hello to you and Jody before we move on to our amazing syncs that have been sent in. How you doing, Lisa?
I'm doing great, thanks. We have some guests here from Tacoma that are visiting, and we're actually converting people to move here as well. So there's no traffic.
Okanagan.
People are nice.
Name anyway.
People are nice to one another here. It's like
I don't know what that's about. But Lisa, I'm definitely coming. I want the Canadian wine. Jody, how are you doing?
Staying out of trouble.
Good. And you got a replacement for your guitar, I think?
Yes, that was my friend Jimmy brought the guitar over, yes.
Yeah, what a cool guy. Well, yes. Mazel tov. I'm glad you have a new axe to grind. and before we jump into the show, let's talk to the man himself, the director, the co-creator, the man with the vision that sees around corners, our director, Kevin Sharpley. How was your panel, my friend?
Yo, panel was great. You know, I was able to talk about the future of the industry, metaverse, and of course, the Zataverse. So now there's more people who know about the Zataverse before our TV launch.
Well, I couldn't be more proud of this team and what we've been able to accomplish in a year's time. All right, we're going to move on. So now, guys, what we're doing with the TV show, obviously, we're going to have score. Phil, who's leading the march with the score for the Sync Report. And as we get to know what the Sync Report is, we'll be asking for briefs on that. But obviously, as I said earlier, Milfredo and I are going to be busy working away on the music supervision, which are syncs. But then there's something in between, right? There's something called the cue, something that's really powerful, accenting what is going on in the scene. It could be 15 seconds, 30 seconds, 90 seconds. So what we're hearing tonight, hopefully, are really powerful instrumental pieces that we can put into the show to help us bridge from one segment to another, one scene to another. Right, Kev?
Yeah.
But I think we need some inspiration. We need some musical inspiration. Paula, who's first up? Who is in the chair? We're not torturing tonight.
We're not.
We're appreciated. Who's in the appreciation chair?
In the appreciation chair. Oh, I like that. First, well, he's already on stage. We have Zach Ware with his instrumental cue, Boat to Havana, number one. Let's hear it, Milfredo.
I'm a sucker for a slide guitar. So, Zach, first off, give a bit of an introduction and tell us a little bit behind the psychology of that cue.
I kind of got an image of one of those moments in Breaking Bad where you wake up in the desert and you've no idea where you are, what's happened. You've got a broken tooth and a black eye and all your money and identity's gone, and you're walking and you just keep on walking. And as you walk, it's just all the sort of psychology of your mind. So that piece actually comes from a sort of an 8-minute piece where there's all these little sections like that, but with different instrumentation around the same theme, but with just the slide as this drown out. And again, it's an 8-minute thing, but at which point pedal steel comes in, classical guitar comes in. Oh. It goes off into a weird sort of strange Clapton on those Roger Water albums. You know, he did that Hitchhiker's record, Roger Waters, years ago. Right. And Clapton plays all this kind of really kind of... He's kind of like really free. He's not like in where he plays in Elsewhere. And it's kind of like goes into that bit. So, yeah.
Well, it's almost like the days when he was in Cream.
Yeah. And even back into the Yardbirds and before, when he was just playing that really clean, clean blues, you know. So there's some little bits like that are kind of in there. So yeah, so it's sort of kind of, but it's all about that big. It's a cigar box guitar, you know. So it's just playing this, just a bit of wire. It's just a bit of wire and metal. That's it. You know, there's nothing else. You're just using it on a couple of strings. Yeah. So that was my thing on that. I edited it all in a hotel room, as is my wont.
Oh. Even cooler. I love it. What a great backstory. Zach, where are you joining us from?
I'm at home today. I'm in Bath.
Oh, you've got a day off the Proclaimers tour.
I have got a day off. I got back this afternoon. We were in Jersey last night.
Lucky you.
Oh, wow. So that's about 500 miles.
Yeah, that's about right. That's what everyone said. Yeah. They did that one.
All right. So you are in the appreciation chair. Let's see if everybody appreciates. Well,
thank you.
This gorgeous, again, that slide was beautiful. We at some point, we have to have like a slide war between him and Durwood. That's Kev, who is very important in these decision makings, because, of course, this is the director of the show. Could you hear that as a cue in your show?
That's definitely a cue. The cue works in a lot of different ways. By the way, I cannot go after Vinks anymore.
All right, so then for now, please. I'm going to go Kevin Vinks.
But definitely, because that cue had everything in it. You know, you had Wild West, you had Old Mississippi. You can use it for a lot of different things. You want that MacGyver of cues, and that one is that. So that's a nice one.
Thank you.
Excellent. All right, Paula, who's next? Who's not? Oh God, I almost said victim. Who's next in the appreciation chair?
Our next guest in the appreciation chair.
Say that five times fast.
Is Colleen McTeague with Shadow Theme. Play it, Milfredo.
Thank you.
Oh, wow, Colleen, you are stepping up your work. I'm so glad to have you back on stage. It's been a minute. How are you, Colleen?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, beautiful submission. I love the bells and the strings. Beautiful sound. Definitely wonderful contribution. Yeah, Colleen, why don't you say a quick hello? You haven't been on stage for a while. So, you know, introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background on the idea and production behind that cue.
Okay, well, my name's Colleen McTeague. I am in the Niagara region in Ontario, Canada. So just a short trip from Buffalo, New York. And this piece grew out of a much shorter piece that I put together for a student short film recently. And it was part of it was used in the title sequence, and the rest of it was used in the end credits, but it was only half as long as it is now. So I liked it so much, I wanted to expand on it and make it even better.
Oh, congratulations. Wow, Colleen, I mean, somebody that is really listening to the advice in these rooms, that is just great. I'm so pleased for you. And I love that you shared that with us. But before we let you off the hook, let's get one more voice in the mix here. Milfredo, what'd you think of that cue?
Do you know what? Although it was short, it still took you on like a massive journey, didn't it? Those, and the compressed strings. It's like, it's not something people do a lot. Everybody does. When they use strings, they just like use the whole sound and stuff, but they were real compressed, like cutting the ends off them. I loved it. It was, do you know what though? I felt harassed by it, which is a good thing. Do you know what I mean? I felt like a little bit disturbed, like problematic. You imagine there was something manic about it. Although it was, you know, smooth, the fact that she'd done that to the strings and stuff. And then at the end, that last kind of, you know, 16 bars, it just all calmed down as if there was like some kind of solution at the end of it. So yeah, what a mad journey for such a small tune. Do you know what I mean? But I loved it. I loved the sound of the strings, and I just love what she'd done with them. So well done, Colleen. I thought it was amazing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Colleen, I honestly, that was what a great way to come back. I mean, talk about breaking down walls and doors and doing it in style. Excellent. How much fun. Let's keep the party going. Paula, who's next?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have another Colleen, I do believe.
Oh, my God.
The next song we have is by Colleen Stewart, and it's called New Day. Play it, Milfredo.
I mean, you know what, just going back to what Milfredo and Kevin were saying, you know, you have such a short amount of time to express an emotion with a cue. And it's so difficult. It's really a difficult skill to hone. But Colleen, that was brilliant. Another one. I mean, we're on fire. Heather, everything so far is going in the bag. That was gorgeous. I loved it. Colleen! Gotcha.
Hey, Jason, how's it going?
I'm great. You just made my night. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good, man. All these Colleens is feeling a little Irish around here.
Yeah, there's a lot of Colleen going on. I like it. It's a lovely name.
If Colleen's brother's name was Patrick, then we're really going to be.
But that's great. Honestly, I have, there's an agenda here. 50% of my show has to be about Ireland. So you're helping us out.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. That was just a small cue I did during the pandemic kind of period where we were all not knowing what the heck was going on. And I wanted it to be hopeful, but still sweet. And, you know, everything's going to be okay, blah, blah, that kind of thing. And
lovely.
I really enjoyed writing it. It was, you know, all live. So.
Wow. That's amazing. Honestly, I'm over the moon. Let's see what Vinx has to say. How's your bag hanging?
If I got to think, it took me immediately to calm/resolution. Like it's like a peaceful thing, like finally there's some sense being made out of it all. It's one of those things that you use for a perfect summary of something. After whatever drama we went through, after you put your beaver in your bag or whatever, there's this moment when you just come to that collective calm and like, yes, thank you. Let me breathe for the next thing. So I thought it was beautiful and very usable in a lot of situations.
Thank you, Vince.
Thanks, Colleen.
All right. Well done, Colleen. Paula, how many more songs do we got? All right. Who's next, Paula?
Okay. Next up is a track called Dystopia. Play it, Milfredo.
Ooh, what a cool title. Okay, another unbelievable. We are on fire tonight. What is going on? I don't know what's going on, but this is so much fun for me. That's brilliant. Paula, who's the artist behind that song?
Who's the artist?
Yeah. I don't know who I'm talking to.
Oh, it's someone called Heather Ragnus?
No, fuck off. I mean, no way.
What? Oh, come on.
My Heather?
No.
Our Heather?
No, I don't believe. That's so different from what Heather does. Heather, is that really you?
Yeah.
No. Wow. Okay. My mind is blown. That was some sneaky stuff going on behind my back by the cast. Thank God it wasn't crap because that would be really embarrassing. That was far from crap. Heather, that was so cool. What was going on there? I mean, that's so different from what you normally do.
Well, I do a lot of instrumental compositions, and I took a scene from a show and just scored it as like practice. So I took just a part of that and exported it and submitted it.
Don't tell us the show yet.
Okay.
This is practice. This is practice to you. Unbelievable. So rad. And that is part of our team. The Sync Report rocks. Unbelievable. All right.
Thank you.
Let me get over my huge crush on Heather at the moment and open it up. Kev, talk to me about that track.
Man, the insidiousness continues. That was dark, sinister. And, you know, in that there was a murder somewhere and you have the detectives that are right there on the prowl and they're on the heels of that vicious serial killer. And it had some sci-fi in there too. So we'll throw that in there too. That track really was everything. Heather, you have a dark side. Oh my God.
Oh, big time.
There's something going on in Canada. I might have to spend some time.
Maybe it happened in Iceland. I think she composed that in Iceland, I think.
Wow, there's some real freaks going on. I love it. We are moving on.
We are moving on. Our final song from the audience of the night is called Over and Above by LD Cirillo Trevino. Play it, Milfredo.
Oh, that's a new name to the stage.
What's happening, man? This is awesome being on here.
Oh, it's awesome having you on here. Talk to me. Introduce yourself. Where are you from? What was that? What was the thought behind recording that track?
Right on. Well, my name is L.D. Trevino. Cirillo's that's my middle name, but I go by L.D. Trevino. Man, I produce a lot of type of music, mainly a lot of Latin beats, commercial stuff, ads. I'm working on several albums right now. Yeah, wow. But as far as that track, I was writing a brief for a commercial, and that was, I wanted to do something more like with a trap feel, you know, but then more with a tropical island a little bit, you know, it's kind of smooth sailing, you know, pop, but it has that trap kind of background on the beat with hi-hats and stuff. So yeah, that was just experimenting with different sounds like that. So that's how that came about. It's real positive. It has a positive vibe, you know, so it's kind of relaxation types, kind of cool song. It could be work good on a movie or whatever.
Oh, definitely. I definitely think it would work good for a movie. That is brilliant. Let's open up to the panelists. Milfredo, you're the one filling my mouth at the moment. Milfredo.
Yeah, I'll move on from that. LD, you mate, you got a good ear, but although Kevin said it, I could hear it. I just wrote a little note there, trap. There's a trap hip-hop tune in there somewhere, and that's exactly what I wrote. But I just loved it, man. It was. Do you know what? This year in the UK has kind of been like the year of the curveball for like hip-hop tracks and stuff. People just using mad samples and stuff, and I could just hear... And I do mashups, loads of mashups for stuff. And I could just imagine chucking like an old Busta Rhymes rap on there or something. It's just, it was beautiful. Everything was crystal. It just kicked. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I could hear like a real, I don't know, like a real, like I say, curveball hip hop track. I imagine someone, you know, spitting some lyrics on there. I think it would really work. So, yeah, good for you, mate. And lovely sounds throughout, real throughout. Everything kicked through just as it should.
Awesome. Thank you. That's awesome. Yeah, that track, like I said, I was experimenting. I don't really do much hip hop, and that's one of my weakest areas, but I do a lot of Latin beats, reggaeton, a lot of Spanish stuff. Gosh, and it's... But that was me venturing out into trying to come up with different genres and different things like that. It's kind of cool.
But yeah, I keep thinking that, sorry, Kev, do you remember the whole kind of Kid Frost LaRaza kind of thing that went on like years ago? Yeah, absolutely. And I just think I'm just waiting for that to be this like resurgence of that. And it keeps sneaking in and like, you know, exactly that you've done there. As soon as I heard it, it was just like, yeah, that needs to happen, that Latin thing. It really does, that Latin beat thing. And I think it will. It does keep sneaking into tracks, doesn't it? And, you know, that was massive at the time. I loved that whole Kid Frost thing. It was great. All those new sounds, introducing those Latino sounds to people. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I know that. I remember that song, This Is For La Raza. Yep, that sounded. This sounded just perfect for that. Absolutely.
Yeah, isn't it? Just smooth, laid back. But yeah, beautiful. Good work, mate. Love it.
I was praying that you were going to use some timbales and some real drums to act like that, and just actually use the real stuff because it's fitting for it. And somebody needs to reintroduce that. Mm. And you're sitting in a beautiful place to really reintroduce that because you don't have to worry about what it's supposed to sound like. You can redefine it with your own, you know. Spices, man.
Mm. And that's cool.
All right, LD.
Man, I appreciate it. Rock on.
Yeah. LD, welcome to the community. Keep submitting music because that was fire. What a night. What a game we had earlier. What music we've had submitted. What panels. What team. Unbelievable. The Sync Report is literally on fire. Thank you to everybody. Thank you, Phil and Jody, Lisa, Heather, of course, Paula, and our panelists, Vinks, Kevin, Milfredo. Nobody does it better. And if you want to be in the south of France, drinking the finest wines, eating the finest food, and making music for film and TV, you're going to join us at the retreat. Go to vinks.com. And yeah, thank you, everybody. This has just been an incredible session. Until next Sunday, God bless. Sign up to the Sync Report, and we'll talk to you soon. Be kind.
What an incredible show tonight. Thank you so much to Tricia Halloran for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and thank you to our listeners for spending your time with us. The Sync Report cast will be back next week with your hosts Rose Ganguza, Jason P. Rothberg, and myself, Colin O'Donoghue. Until next time, take care and be kind.
Thank you for listening. Tune in next week.
Today's episode was produced by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Paula Flack, and Robert Capadonna. It was written by Jason P. Rothberg, Kevin Sharpley, Lisa Dunn, and Paula Flack. Editing was by Jason P. Rothberg, Milfredo Seven, Paula Flack, Edgar Edge Kamei, and Adam McNamara. Research by Lisa Dunn. Graphic design by Jody Lynn Talevi. Brought to you by Zavatar.